Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in. I'm the ESOP guy. We are on a journey to an ESOP. For those that are tuning in, maybe for the first time, this is a podcast that goes through all of the attributes of an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, and the applicability of how do you use an ESOP for your plan, primarily for your succession and exit plan. So before we get started, I wanted to mention as we continue to do this podcast, we've had some questions and different things like that come up over the last year or so. So we're going to start a program called ESOP Guy Live. It's a webinar series that will be on our website. So you'll be able to look for more information there. And our website is at journeytoanesop.com. So I had recently produced and published an episode on this podcast for contractors and wanted to go through and explain the particulars of how a contractor's business works within the realm of using an employee stock ownership plan. So the applicability of an ESOP for contractors. So today I wanted to go in and do an interview and get deeper into that side of things. So the title of this podcast today is ESOPs for Contractors, an ESOP attorney's perspective. To do that, we have the opportunity to interview Ben Wells, who's with Dinsmore Law Firm out of Cincinnati, Ohio. Ben has been a partner at Dinsmore since 1995. Before that, he had worked at a national accounting firm in a consulting practice. So with all that, I wanted to welcome Ben to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Phil. Glad to be here.
Great. Cool. So as we start, I just wanted to kind of get into a little bit of your background before we talk a little bit specifically more about contractors. So can you give us a little overview of your work in ESOP transactions and just working with ESOP companies in general?
Sure. I always enjoy talking about ESOP, so I appreciate the opportunity. I've been working with ESOPs and ESOP companies almost my entire career. Back in the beginning, we mostly saw ESOPs with financial institutions, or at least that was the nature of our practice. But as time went on, we saw more and more interest to business owners who were looking to transition ownership or take some chips off the table, and the benefits of an ESOP became more attractive to those folks and more well known as time went on.
So you've been working at ESOPs for your entire career as an attorney, and you mentioned like in your background working in a consulting practice with a national accounting firm. Were you working with ESOPs back then?
Yes, actually, that's when I started. That firm had a specialty in financial institutions, and we worked on a number of thrift conversions, which always involved an ESOP. And we took that ESOP practice and expanded it to privately owned businesses of all types. And pretty soon after we started that, we saw the benefits of ESOPs to contractors. And I've been involved in the transition of ownership to an ESOP in a large number of contractors.
Nice. So your office is in Cincinnati. And I know you guys have an office in DC. What's your geography? What do you cover in terms of the scope of the country in terms of working on ESOPs?
Our ESOP practice is national, so I've been involved in ESOP transactions everywhere from California to Vermont, and most of the places in between. So it really is it's not a state or locally oriented practice. I would say the majority of my clients are within probably 300 miles or so of Cincinnati, but we really do ESOP transactions all over the country.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of mention it kind of because that is very typical for most people that do ESOP work. You do work all over the place. And has it been difficult because of COVID for you guys to do, you know, the work that you have, or has that been kind of just more Zoom meetings and different things like that people are experienced with?
Yeah, the transition to electronic communication has been actually pretty easy. We were doing ESOP transactions mostly electronically anyway. I haven't been to a live closing in probably 15 years. They've always been done remotely. The one difference is that we don't get to go to live conferences or other meetings to meet other ESOP professionals and potential clients. So a lot of that now needs to be done remotely. But we're adapting like everyone else.
Yeah, everybody's adapting, whether they like it or not sometimes. But
exactly.
Before we get into one other question I had, just kind of your background, and I know talking to other ESOP attorneys, some work a lot more with trustees and represent the trustees on transactions, and others work more on the company side where they're actually doing the plan documents. Where do you say, where do you fall in more, or is it kind of equally split?
I tend to work mostly on the company side. I have represented ESOP trustees and still do. But I would say three-fourths of my business is on the company side, with the remainder split between trustees and lenders. We also have a pretty significant practice representing banks who are lending into ESOP transactions.
Okay, great, great. So thank you. Good. I think that's a great overview of your background. As we go into the discussion on the contractors, one of the things, like for us as a CPA firm, we've been working with contractors, really kind of since the beginning of our firm back in 1958. And, our practice has, I would say our largest industry niche is contractors and throughout the Central Florida area. So we're very experienced in working with them on just the normal audit and CPA work, the tax work. As we have obviously focused our practice on succession planning and a lot of succession and exit planning, obviously ESOP's going to come up a lot. And I thought this would be a great topic because, the contracting business is very cyclical, and there are definitely specific aspects to a contractor business that are unique. And so kind of with that, you know, from your perspective, as we start thinking about just generally speaking, how well does an ESOP work as a solution for a contractor to help them accomplish their succession and their exit goals?
An ESOP can be a great solution for contractors. Obviously, you know, and particularly if you've got steady business and a strong backlog and, you know, pretty good history behind you, that helps, but we've seen all types of contractors use an ESOP as a transition device. Obviously, as you point out, it's a different business than manufacturing or service business, and so there's complexities that need to be addressed. Most of those relate to, of course, financing, bonding, and indemnity issues. But all in all, we've seen a lot of contractors use the ESOP route, and it's been successful.
Mm-hmm. So we kind of dig into, and I'm going to agree with you, I think it's just a great option as we start thinking about, and that's, I mean, obviously why I'm doing the podcast to direct towards that, but when you start looking at some of the particular issues and talking through some things that I think are important, especially when you think about going into 100% ESOP purchase, which for purposes of discussion, it's like you're taking your whole balance sheet at that point. Now we've leveraged the entire purchase back into the balance sheet with ESOP debt, and or the seller has taken a note back, and then there's this cash flow, you know, strain on this, on the company. And so that's going to create some issues. And then you have the whole idea behind the personal guarantee. Typically the contractor has a bonding line, and the bonding line usually has an indemnity or guarantee by the owner. And so some of those issues, can come up. What would you say, kind of from just your experience at dealing with those kind of things, what would you say a contractor needs to do to kind of get themselves ready for that process?
Well, you need the stronger your balance sheet, of course, the better you are. We we find that a lot of contractors have cash on the books because they've, you know, seen a lot of ups and downs, and so they want to make sure that they, you know, have enough cash to operate if things get lean. But you have to realize that there is, as you point out, there is going to be a lot of debt on the balance sheet after the transaction, and you may show a negative net worth, at least in the initial years. So that's going to make your bonding company uncomfortable. And the ESOP, if you do 100% transaction and you've got the ESOP as 100% owner of the company, that ESOP's not going to be able to provide an indemnity. They just won't do it.
No.
So, and in addition, if there's outside bank financing, the bank's going to insist on a first priority to all the other creditors. So the first step you have to do if you're looking at an ESOP transaction is to have a discussion with your surety bond company and see whether they understand the concept of an ESOP. Some of the larger ones do and have experience with them. Many don't. And in that case, you're going to have to educate them, which could be a difficult process. Another thing is, in terms of getting ready for an ESOP transaction, is you're going to need to think about your transition plan. Most people are thinking of an ESOP because they're looking at the possibility of moving the business on to the next generation or to the management over time. And so you want to make sure that you have a strong second generation in place that's able to run the company. That's going to be important to an ESOP trustee, and it will be important to lenders as well. So that's something that you're going to need to focus on if you haven't thought about it in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I think is important is, and this is because I do a lot of the upfront advisory, is, you know, create the transaction as if it happened, work into your transaction or, you know, your planning documents, some kind of pro forma balance sheet to estimate what your balance sheet's going to look like after the ESOP transactions happened. And putting together enough information for the bonding company to review at a from a post ESOP level is very helpful, because then they can give you some feedback on their comfort levels with how that's changing things, especially on 100% ESOP, because 100% ESOP, it's going to be a lot more impactful to the company. And where in, if a contractor is just doing a partial ESOP, that's going to have some impact, but it's not going to have, you know, the dramatic impact, you know, a fully leveraged transaction would have. But I also agree with what Ben's saying too. The transition plan is very important. And if you're planning to exit the business, there needs to be a very clear resume of some people that are available and are in the business that are working that can operate the company the same at the same level and really at the level of how you have created the forecast to look. So if that's not in place, then I think it's very difficult for the trustee to buy off on the risk there, and it's going to be a negotiation that might really be less than what you think is favorable. So
absolutely. Yeah. And as to the seller financing and the company's balance sheet, it's important to keep in mind that there's a lot of flexibility in how the seller financing can be structured. And so what we see a lot is that the seller may only get current pay on interest for a while, or may even defer some of the interest to a later date, particularly if there is bank financing. Typically, if you've got senior debt financing from a bank, they're going to want the seller only to get some amount of interest, usually, you know, 4% or so on an ongoing basis until the bank is paid off, and then the seller gets is interest payments paid in a lump sum or in arrears. And so in the same process can be discussed with the bonding company. They have to understand that, you know, there's a lot of flexibility in the seller financing, and even though the balance sheet doesn't look very good, if the seller debt is subordinated to the surety bond company, they can feel a lot more secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's you can't go into this and thinking you can do this without their input, because they're really vital to a company as you move forward, and you want to create an ESOP that's sustainable, that doesn't have like a backlash at, you know, afterwards that's going to affect you as a selling shareholder. You had kind of mentioned some of the things we talked about, you using a holding company structure with an ESOP. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of structuring that with the subsidiary operating company to keep the balance sheet more normal?
We've just been involved in a transaction where we are this company has a building where they're headquartered and also has an operating company. So what we're going to do is reorganize with a holding company structure, and the real estate company and the operating company will both be subsidiaries of the holding company. And we'll have the ESOP debt at the holding company level, which is going to keep the operating company, which will continue to exist as a corporation, even though it'll be disregarded for tax purposes. And that company will have a clean balance sheet. So obviously this all needs to be disclosed. You can't hide the ball with respect to the surety bond company or anybody else.
Right, yeah.
But it does enable you to show you've got a company with a good balance sheet, and that can sometimes make the bonding company more comfortable.
Sure. That's it. That's interesting. So in that structure, you had one company with real estate in the operating company, and then you split those entities out as subsidiary entities?
No, actually, this real estate was owned separately.
Oh, that was owned separately. Got it. Okay. So
yeah.
So all you're doing.
And so the owners decided to. It was the ownership was the same as the operating company, but it was in a separate entity, and so the owners decided to contribute that to the holding company as well. So they've got everything in one place.
Oh, okay. And so for the holding company would show the debt, the operating company wouldn't, but obviously all the information is going to be caught up in the financial statement anyway. So the bonding company will see it, you know, as you go through.
Well, the holding company will have a consolidated financial statement, but the operating company will have separate reviewed financial statements.
Yeah, that they use for other purposes, right? For bonding and banking.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Very interesting. Very interesting, Ben. So some of the stuff that I get into is, you know, underwriting the work for a potential ESOP for a contractor is you review the forecast. And the forecast is integral to the business valuation, and it's going to be integral to the feasibility, because it's going to be really our way to estimate what the future cash flows are in terms of the payment of the notes and the effect of the tax treatment as an ESOP. And so all that's going to be, you know, very important in the process of planning. This forecasting is like for a contractor can be really difficult, because what we're talking about is, you know, sources of revenue that are subject to business cycles. And, you know, as we've kind of been living in the last decade outside of the like 07, 08, 09 period. But that still wasn't that long ago. And so coming back into a cycle is difficult to even predict at this point. Especially as you got, you know, you come through COVID year in 2020, and people thought that was going to be a difficult year, and it turned out to be, you know, not so bad for a lot of companies. When we're talking about that part of planning, how does that factor in? Because it is definitely difficult to predict. How does that factor into structuring the ESOP deal from your perspective?
Sure. Yeah. Obviously, you know, forecasting revenues is difficult in any business, but particularly in an industry like construction. when they're determining value for purposes of the transaction, and just every ESOP trustee hires a valuation firm to tell them how much they can pay for the company stock, they're going to look at not just the forecasted revenues, but they're also going to look at things like the customer base. So are these, you know, does the company focus on governmental projects, healthcare? That may, you know, those types of projects may have one level of predictability, whereas things like retail or industrial may have another level. So, and that'll affect the discount factor that they apply in determining the value. They'll also look at the history of the business through prior business cycles, and even, you know, to the strength of management and some other factors relating to the business to determine, you know, how solid is this business and what kind of history does it have, and so how reliable are the forecasts that we're using to determine the value. As to the structure of the deal, what we'll find is if there's a situation where, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but things are, you know, you've got some good forecasts that, you know, things are looking good for the company, but they may be in a business that is in transition, or, you know, the industry may be volatile. We'll sometimes see clawback provisions, in a deal. And obviously sellers don't necessarily like these because it means that the purchase price could be reduced retroactively based on the company's performance after the closing. But it can help make a trustee more comfortable with paying a higher price if they know that if things really go bad, they'll be able to recover some of what was paid. And the way that's done typically is just by a reduction in the amount of the seller notes after the transaction. That's a structure that used to be pretty unusual, but we're seeing more and more of it, and particularly in businesses like construction that have a lot of volatility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing it as well, and I think the other side of it is when, you know, we'll go back into the idea of a clawback. It does protect, you know, the trustee's decision is a difficult decision because they don't want to overpay for the business itself. And so they want to protect the employees from having that happen if the forecast isn't accomplished. And, on the other side though, the seller, if they're looking at a clawback, we would also want to kind of think about, is it possible for them to get, the upside advantage as well? So more like an earnout with a purchase price adjustment if they exceed the forecast. And so what's your opinion on that structure, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to address the need the trustee has for the clawback and trying to come back with something more positive for the seller to absorb some of that risk?
We've seen that as well. Not as much, but it certainly stands to reason. If you're going to have a clawback on one side, you should have the right to, you know, get a little of the upside if the company does better than expected. So it's certainly not out of the question. Sometimes that's a conversation, or it makes sense to have that conversation with a trustee even before the trustee's hired. Mm-hmm. Usually we'll interview several trustees in advance of the transaction, and if it looks like an earnout or clawback is a possibility in this deal, we will have that discussion with the trustee ahead of time to find out whether they're agreeable to that kind of a structure.
Yeah, I mean, I agree totally. You want to have that conversation in the interview process so you can see where they lie on that issue. And if they don't, you know, clearly you got to make that decision as to, is that trustee the right one for the transaction, and look at what you think is right. But if, you know, they can't see all, like my point would be, they can't see everything. So they're going to probably say something like, you know, it really kind of depends on what we're after, you know, as we go through due diligence, but you at least wanted to see if they're flexible towards that, you know, as you go through it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I like the point on the kind of the revenue, and I would just draw that out a little bit deeper, that the stability behind the revenue of a contractor can be vastly different between different types of contractors, because some they can have all kinds of business in all different types of places with different types of, you know, brand new clients and customers, or they can specialize like in government, and, you know, and so it really kind of depends not only on the customer base, but, you know, the ability of them to win work in their, in this particular niches. One thing I look for is, you know, do they have a history of taking on jobs that are difficult for them? And they, you know, looking at that contract schedule, completed contract schedule, and really looking at if they're able to perform on what they've estimated, or they have a couple big, you know, losses every year. And those, even though they might be profitable, those could be difficult when you're actually estimating the forecast and can really hurt them. So you want to see a company that can estimate contracts really well, can be profitable on pretty much all of their contracts. If they do have a bad one in the last couple of years, that's not so bad. You can talk through what happened. But if it's a, if it's like that's routinely the thing that happens, then I think there's a deeper conversation about what does that translate to the valuation itself and the possibility of maybe more rigid deal structure. So.
Exactly. Everybody's going to have a bad job once in a while, but if you make a habit of it, that tends to hurt your value.
Exactly. So kind of turning our focus a little bit now on the employees, which, you know, the first thing I would say is if you're doing an ESOP and you want your employees to be a beneficial owner, and they're important. They're important to contractors' business, probably, you know, and I think every company that has employees, everybody's employees important. But when you look at contractors, I mean, I think they're really important. And some of these people have been there, you know, their whole careers. Some of them really help the owner to get to where they are. And so the owner really wants to reward them. When you look at the applicability of an ESOP, though, there, and you have a contractor that has, say, you know, maybe a lot of turnover or a lot of union employees, does it make sense to still consider an ESOP?
And I would say yes, absolutely. In fact, we are working on a deal right now with a union shop, and the union employees are going to be participating in the ESOP. You have to have a discussion with the union ahead of time because it is a bargainable item. However, if you're adding the ESOP on top of the other benefits and not changing anything, then it's unlikely that the union's going to object. But it is something that needs to be disclosed ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But talking about a business with high turnover, an ESOP can be a factor that helps reduce turnover. It is something that gives employees an incentive to stick around, because as time goes by, the value of their account's going to go up as long as the business stays healthy. And it takes a few years. In the initial years, when a participant gets a statement, it's not going to look like very much. But as time goes by, the value of that thing can go up exponentially. And, an employee who's been with you for a number of years can have a really significant benefit from the ESOP. And so employees start talking about that, and, it becomes a real factor in helping to hang on to people. Mm-hmm. So we find that, in a business that is that has high turnover, there's always a number of factors at work, and so an ESOP isn't going to solve every problem, but it's certainly something that can help.
Yeah, and I think I want to state the obvious, because sometimes people listen and they don't understand actually the way it works, because I get this question a lot: is the employees actually get this benefit? And they're not paying for it. They're there. And that's why the unions are going to be okay with it if they feel like it fits into what they're thinking is potentially, you know, the right thing for the employee. But, I think that's important. So that is why, the employees, because they get this benefit without really paying for it, that is why it can be such a positive, attribute to the company's success of really helping to retain key people, or retain all the people that really see the big picture, especially if the company's growing in value.
Exactly.
So one of the magic questions we always get is, hey, how am I getting my money? I've done all this, you know, I've listened to all your stuff. I knew, you know, I want to get my money now. So let's talk a little bit about financing an ESOP transaction for, you know, a contractor.
Sure. So there's different ways to finance it, but most of them, most transactions involve a combination of outside financing, that is from a bank or other lender, and seller financing. Obviously, if you have bank financing, they're going to want to have priority. They're going to want to be paid first, they're not going to permit much in the way of payments to any of the sellers until the bank is paid off. But the bank financing then can be used to provide, first of all, pay the expenses of the transaction, pay off any existing debt, and to provide some cash for the sellers at closing. If you're doing a 100% ESOP transaction, it's pretty certain that you're going to have seller financing on top of that. As I mentioned earlier, that's going to be subordinate to the bank financing, and it may allow, there may be some interest payments on the seller financing, but until the bank's paid off, the seller's not going to get very much from those seller notes. Once the bank is paid off, and this can happen fairly quickly if things go well, then usually what'll happen is you can refinance the bank debt and pay off the seller financing, at least, if not all, or at least in part, and then go on from there.
Yeah, I think that some of the rule of thumb on what the bank's going to be able to finance. And I've done a number of podcasts with ESOP lenders, but, you know, I think around two times cash flow is probably on average, you know, sometimes going to be three times, maybe plus that. But, that means that, you know, depending on your multiple on the actual deal, there's going to be definitely some seller financing left over, and you just kind of prepare for that as part of part of what to expect when you're looking at how to get your money out of the transaction.
Right. And the amount of bank debt is going to depend, as you know, as we talked about before in valuation, it's going to depend on the nature of the business, how steady are the cash flows. The bank's also going to look at assets. So if you're an asset rich company, you know, it's going to be easier to borrow from a bank than it will be if you're not. So
yeah, a little more collateral.
It can vary, but yeah, it's I think what you mentioned is a good rule of thumb.
Yep. So, you know, looking at some of the particular things that we just kind of identified, it might be what else this question is like, what should the contractor be thinking about down the road? How do they address, you know, the issues early on in the process that you think might be, you know, concerns that they should have at this point?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, you're going to want to look at the transition plan for the business. Obviously, most sellers aren't going to be looking at doing an ESOP or some other similar device unless they're thinking about transitioning the business. But make sure that you've got good leadership in place that's able to take over the business once you're gone. Many people, you know, have just been so busy with their nose to the grindstone, they haven't really been able to think about developing the next generation. Well, now's the time, if you haven't already done it, now's the time to start and make sure that you've got folks behind you who are capable of, you know, stepping in over the long haul. And if you don't have those people, then, you know, you may have to start to look for them.
One question I asked Ben is like, I always ask the owner that's selling, like, how many hours a week do you work? You know, and if they
exactly.
say, yep. if they say I'm working 60 to 80 hours a week, I'm like, well, you know, you probably aren't there yet. Right. But the other side is like, I don't have to really come in the office because everything's getting done. So you have these different spectrums, and you kind of know at that point, hey, we need to either work on that plan a little bit deeper, or, you know, we've got it nailed down. And then you just have to talk about the resumes of the people that are really managing the company on a day-to-day basis.
In most cases, we find that's exactly right. And in most cases, and I expect your experience is the same, Phil, this is a 10-year process, and it's 5 years of planning and thinking about it prior to the transaction, and then another 5 or more years after the transaction to fully transition it to the next generation. And so, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, if you're thinking about transitioning your business, you know, within the next 10 years, you know, you should probably, you know, start now.
That's actually very good. I always say 5 because people 10 years is like, what, you know, but I definitely agree with you, because the more time you have to plan it, the better it's going to go, because of the, especially just the idea of transition planning. I mean, as far as what your business is worth right now in 10 years, who knows, but actually planning who's coming up in the ranks. If you don't have a strategic person, you need, maybe you're hiring a strategic person in your company, to build out your management group. If your forecast shows a lot of growth, you know, I always tell people, you know, try, if you're trying to get from, say, a $20 million company in revenue to $40 million, you know, you got to start acting like, you know, a $30 or $40 million company before you get there. So you have to, you know, put in place people that can help you get there. Otherwise, the companies are always kind of tend to stay back in that same revenue level because they just don't think about the future as much. So I think those are good points to kind of think about in your preparation process. We didn't mention it, but I know one of the concerns is repurchase obligation. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of what they should be thinking about down the road and what that will mean for them in terms of the actual ESOP?
Sure. So it's important to remember what an ESOP is, and that is it's a plan that allocates stock in the company to employees, and it's part of the company's retirement program. So when an employee retires, he can't take that stock to the grocery store and buy food with it. So you have to be able to convert it to cash. And the way it's converted to cash essentially is that the company buys the shares back over time. And we call that the repurchase obligation. The law allows you to stretch that obligation out for a very long time. So it's generally not something you have to worry about in the initial years of the ESOP. But as time goes by, and after the seller, usually after the seller financing is paid off, then you're going to have to start buying those shares back from employees that retire or leave the company. And so it's important that you have a source of funding for that. Now, that can be, you can do a sinking fund inside the company. You can do cash contributions to the ESOP. There's several ways that you can structure paying the repurchase obligation. But it's something that once the ESOP is established, you have to start thinking about. And usually the first step is to do a repurchase obligation study that looks at your employee census and figures out roughly when these cash needs are going to arise based on the age of your employees and the value of the company, and then plans for a way to accumulate the resources that you're going to need to meet that obligation.
Yeah, so that's excellent, because it's sometimes people want to talk about that, and I think, you know, the idea is like, what should you be thinking about? As Ben said, it's definitely something you can plan early on for, and you shouldn't have to worry about it too much, but you do need to know about it as part of the whole process. The other thing you need to know, and comes up quite frequently in conversations, is the, you know, governance of the company pre-ESOP, post-ESOP. So I have a company as a contractor run by maybe a single owner, sells the business out, and now it's a controlling interest to an ESOP. What should he or she expect in the process of going through that change when it comes to the, when I say governance, it comes to really the structure of leadership and the organization of the company in terms of its, of how it's going to be actually run in the future.
Right. So if you've got a single, a company owned by a single individual, and that person's done everything, chairman, sole member of the board of directors, you know, chief executive officer, et cetera. That structure is going to have to change somewhat. Typically, a trustee of an ESOP will want there to be an active board, that is a board that actually has meetings or at least does written actions at least once a year. It's going to want some documentation of the structure, so, you know, actual corporate minutes and bylaws, et cetera. And so for some businesses have this in place, and, you know, most of our clients already follow good governance practices, but there's a lot of businesses out there that don't. So for those businesses, it may be a challenge, or it may take some getting used to. What it generally is going to mean is that you're going to need a board of directors, usually of three people. And if it's a three-person board, it can be two people appointed by the company, one of whom can be the selling shareholder. And usually they're going to want to see one outside independent board member. Now, that independent board member can be someone that the company chooses, but it can't be someone who's been a service provider or a family member or has any other connection to the company. We usually find that once companies get used to that, there tends to be some discomfort at the beginning among some companies and some sellers that they're going to lose control of the company and the trustee's going to take it over. In fact, that I would say almost never happens. The only time that the trustee really ever becomes active in the management of the business if there are really serious problems, then the trustee's obviously going to have to pay attention to what's going on. But for the most part, you know, other than appointing an independent director, we find that the management of the company and the operation of the company continues as it did before, with perhaps a little bit more focus on bringing the next generation on, because again, that's the goal of the seller, is ultimately to be able to cash out of the business and move it on to the next generation.
Yeah, and that's really good. I think sometimes it's healthy, and sometimes when you're thinking about that, you're not sure exactly what that looks like, but people stepping into new roles and new leadership and bringing up the next group is really a good part for everybody. So I think, like, I would agree with what you said. It's definitely not like you're having somebody take over your company and you're like, you have to listen to somebody at that point. Like, the trustee's going to tell you what to do. It's more like you're still doing what you were doing before. If you're exiting the business, obviously that's different, but if you're staying in the company, then likely you're obviously going to be on the board and you're going to have a lot of say so in what's happening day to day, just like you were before. So, but it's a good point to make. I just wanted to make sure we addressed it, you know, in terms of the process that happens when you actually finalize the completion of an ESOP. So,
no, it is a great point, and it's, you know, it's something that almost every seller is concerned about, and understandably so. They've been in control of the business for a long time, and so they're concerned about giving up control. But at the end of the day, for almost every situation, it's a non-issue.
Yeah. I totally agree with what you're saying. And it's a little more formality, I think, that people are used to, but it's, other than that, I think it's just not going to be that much different than what you're used to. So all of that's been helpful. I mean, I know we covered a lot of ground. I wanted to kind of make just some final comments. And, I think what I got out of the podcast was just this episode was, you know, the uniqueness of a actual contractor type company and how they go forward. Definitely isn't a deal killer for an ESOP. I think there's attributes that are really important, but the main thing for me is planning so incredibly important. And basically connecting the dots with your bonding companies, with your bank, the people that are really involved in, helping the company do what it does. I think that's going to be, to me, a critical area of importance when you think about this episode, this podcast.
Yep. It takes some groundwork and some preparation. But at the end of the day, it can be a great solution for a lot of companies.
Great. Well, with all of that, I just wanted to kind of stop and say thank you for your time today, Ben. I know Ben's very busy. He's always got stuff going on. So he made time for us today to do that. I thank you so much for that. I really think it does help a lot of people when they listen to this. They get some information that they need, and it's hard to, especially now with not having as many conferences, it's hard to get, you know, information from just objective people saying, hey, this is out there. I always say, ask your advisor, you know, and people that you know. The people that you really trust, but use these podcasts. They're very helpful, I think. So with that, I just want to say thank you for your time today, Ben.
Well, thank you, Phil. I've enjoyed it.
Cool. So as we close out, I wanted to remind everyone, if you like the podcast, please subscribe and share it with a friend. Look for the ESOP Guy Live webinars coming up, and have a great day. We look forward to our next step on this journey to an ESOP.